Live from New York City, it's the Gary Mel Show. And now, your host, Gary Mel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Mel, on the road. Broadcasting today through our studios in New York City and to all the stations, including our sister station where I've been going on 43 years, WBAI, we welcome you. Today, the latest on why, when I'm suggesting that do all that's humanly possible to lose extra weight because you're going to suffer a consequence, there's a brand new study from Harvard School of Public Health published in the Cancer Journal for Clinicians that supports that in a very unfortunate way. A lot more on health and healing. And again, what we do every day is we research the world literature to find studies that impact people everywhere because we're heard everywhere. And that's why we select the different topics. Also, we have a rather large group of people listening that want to hear more critical social issues from a fair and objective point of view. And so we have that today also. In the second part of our program, we're going to be hearing from a woman. She supports feminism, but she does not support modern feminism, which is undermining itself. And she lays out her arguments at a TED Talk. Listen carefully what she has to say. You could agree in part or whole. You could disagree, but it's important that we have a forum for ideas that may be in support of what we believe or challenging us. And why do I do that? Because I cannot tell you how many times people who otherwise were very intelligent, very aware in their areas of expertise, when it came to listening to something they had no knowledge of, refused to listen. They refused to acknowledge there was any reality in it. And as a result, it frequently challenged the relationship, and in some cases ended the relationship. So I believe we should hear things that we would oppose so that we hear it in proper context and then offer our arguments to oppose it. Or how many of you right now are listening who one time believed completely in the absolute public health science of vaccinations? Who believe that as long as you ate the basic four food group, mainly meat and starches, that you'd be healthy, that it didn't matter that there was fluoride or chlorine in your water, because your body can handle all things in moderation, and that you believe that if you were a good Democrat, you voted Democrat. Didn't matter who the candidate was, and you rarely, if ever, found out what they voted on. You believed in it. At some point, 112 million Americans decided to stop believing and start looking. That is going from intentional ignorance through intentional neglect. And neglect becomes the significant catchpin to ignorance. If we're neglectful of a topic, it's because we choose not to be in any way changing our opinion, even if what we're doing is unhealthy, like smoking or drinking. Well, I'm just social drinking. Yeah. No, you were out last night. You did not get drunk. You enjoyed yourself with your friends. Good. But while you were doing this, your kidney cells, liver cells, heart cells, and brain cells lost about 4 million cells. They died. So, black walnuts. Why should we eat black walnuts? Because we don't eat black walnuts. We should. They really have a great flavor. Because they contain compounds to boost our health. This is from the University of Missouri, and what they have are called phytosterols. And phytosterols have been shown to help prevent obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease while promoting lower cholesterol and lower inflammation and anti-cancer activity in the body. Quote, the health benefits of phytosterols are well known, and now we have critical information for both consumers and producers that shows black walnuts are a great diet option for those looking to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. And that's from the research professor at the University of Missouri. So eat black walnuts. One more thing, one more piece of the puzzle. And also eat spinach. This is from the Kanandi College of Pharmacy in India, published in the Journal of Complementary and Integrative Medicine, found that spinach, whether raw in a juice or eating it regularly, is very good at neutralizing excess stomach acid, which makes it an excellent remedy for heartburn, sour stomach, and acid indigestion and stomach upset. So it contains lots of powerful medicinal nutrients, including antioxidant phytoconstituents. And that's important. So have some spinach in a salad or put it in the juice when you're juicing the other greens each day. And also, remember I mentioned that we have to have time each day for restorative sleep and quality time because it's restorative? Well, in point of fact, the University of Alberta came up with new research. They were a group of neuroscientists showing that you're exposed to higher levels of oxygen, encouraging the brain to remain in deep restorative sleep. And the researchers found that we increase our oxygen when we exercise. That's good. So exercising in the early evening would be one way to have a more restorative sleep at night. And that is important. Also, a study shows the benefits of sex for older adults. This is from Anglia Ruskin University and University College of London. And it was published in the peer-reviewed journal of Sexual Medicine. It just means that sexual activity is associated with improved well-being, especially among older individuals. Not just because you could enjoy yourself, but because it actually is good for you. You bring down your stress hormones. You bring up the feel-good hormones. And all this is associated with quality of life and a longer life. And from the University of Veracruz, which is down in Mexico, they're recommending blue maize. That's M-A-I-Z-E. And why? Because it's a good alternative to help prevent metabolic syndrome. This was published in the Journal of Medicinal Food. So blue maize, you don't get it in America unless you're looking for special seeds, then you can, heirloom seeds. But if you've ever been to a farmer's market and you've seen the colorful corn, well, I'm quite sure that they're going to have some blue maize in there. It's also grown in southwestern United States, and it can help attenuate the condition's symptoms. So anyone with pre-diabetes or full-grown diabetes, you're more susceptible to obesity, hypertension, heart disease, and collectively, these increase your risk of dying prematurely, mainly through a stroke or heart attack. So to manage these conditions, regular exercise, that helps. Changing your diet to a plant-based diet, that certainly helps. And also, there are supplements you can take, like chromium picolinate, vitamin C, L-taurine. These are all important. Magnesium is important, especially for your heart. Coenzyme Q10, vitamin C, quercetin, all important. But then you've got one other thing that can make a difference, and that's the blue maize. And adding to something I mentioned yesterday about the power of fasting, University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center came up with a study showing that fasting kills cancer cells of common childhood leukemia. That is important because that is one of the most common types of childhood leukemia, and it's very deadly. So fasting can help than modified fasting it should be. That's brand new research. Why? Because the researchers found that fasting both inhibits the initiation and reverses the progression of two subtypes of acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or all B cell and all T cell. The same method did not work with acute myeloid leukemia, the type that is more common in adults. All the most common type of leukemia found in children can occur at any age, but it's one more way of helping people with important conditions survive. And also, University of Queensland, which is down in Australia, says that beta glucans, G-L-U-C-A-N-S, from oats, you generally get it from oats, is very important in helping your health on many different levels, cholesterol levels, blood pressure, and hence lowering your risk of heart disease. Now, beta-glucan is a soluble fiber naturally occurring in the cell walls of some plants, particularly cereals, and it's believed to kind of mop up the bile secreted during digestion and prevent its absorption in the small intestine. So oat fiber, beta-glucan, actually lowers, instead of just maintaining, the total level circulating of bile in the body. So just one more piece of information to help us. And also, Alzheimer's protein plaques may also harm the heart, from Harvard Medical School. And these protein fragments are called amyloid, A-M-Y-L-O-I-D, beta, B-E-T-A. And tests of heart tissue samples revealed that the hearts of Alzheimer's patients had increased levels of amyloid beta. And sticky amyloid beta chunks create plaques between neurons that are a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. And similar deposits can be found in the heart, and that's dangerous. So go on a plant-based diet with all the information I've shared with you about helping turn off inflammation and then restore the neurons. It's all doable. It's all possible. What I'd like to do now is share some just simple insights from a person I never heard of him until about a year ago. His name's Prince A.E. And let's hear what he has to say. I think it's of value, and let me know what you think.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is a rotten tomato. Nobody in their right mind would eat this because it's rotten and you would get sick. Yet, see, when it comes to the mind, we eat rotten, poisonous, dirty thoughts every day. Here are some examples. And you know what happens when we eat these rotten thoughts? We get sick. We get depression, anxiety, outrage, overwhelm. Our culture has normalized sickness. They feed it to us on a silver platter, making us not insane, but definitely unsane. Krishnamurti said that it is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. And yes, we are sick. Yes, we are so sick that our society cares more about oral hygiene than mental hygiene. We brush and floss every day, twice a day, to keep our teeth nice, fresh, and clean. But what about mental hygiene? What do? For most of us, nothing. But if I was to ask you, would you rather lose all of your teeth or lose your mind, what would you pick? Exactly. You would happily be a toothless motherfucker if you could keep your mental health. Now, I'm not saying don't brush your teeth. I'm saying we need to start treating mental health like it's supposed to be treated. We are in dire need of mental health practices and support in our society. And if we don't, we will continue to see the devastation that we see today. John Milton said, "The mind is its own place. It can make a heaven out of hell or a hell out of heaven." Napoleon Hill once said that thoughts are things, and powerful things at that. Everything you see around you in your room right now was a thought first before it existed in the physical form. The world is the mind. So if we're unhealthy here, what do we create? An unhealthy world out there. My message to government is not focusing on mental health and only changing laws is like putting a Band-Aid on a broken leg or trying to stop an overflowing sink by throwing towels on the floor. Yeah, you're gonna clean up the water, but you're gonna need an infinite amount of towels until you get down there and fix the pipes, because that's where the problem started. So I'm saying we need to fix our mental health, because this is where our problems start. Imagine if every school taught classes on mindfulness or how to deal with rejection, anxiety, depression, or loneliness. And imagine if these classes were taught mandatory like science or social studies. I don't know when that's gonna happen, but I cannot end this video without giving you a simple mental health practice that you can do right now. And if you combine this technique with proper sleep, exercise, nutrition, sunlight, and good friends, you just might start floating off the ground. Now, I mention all these activities because, see, you can't talk about mental health without talking about brain health. And all of the activities that I just mentioned, according to John Medina in his book, Brain Rules, help to create a healthy, happy brain. Now, I call this technique the smiling, mindful breath. It combines three of the most powerful tools that we have available to us: smiling, mindfulness, and breathing. Number one, smiling. What is in a smile? Well, a simple smile can relax your entire nervous system. According to the facial feedback hypothesis, the facial muscles have the largest impact on our emotional state. See, when you smile, even when you're unhappy, the brain senses the flexing of certain muscles and it thinks, hey, I must be happy about something, resulting in your mood being lifted. Number two, mindfulness meditation. Is your mind running your life? Do you believe everything that you think? See, the more watchful and objective you are to the thoughts that come in and out of your field of awareness, the less you will be overwhelmed and trapped by them. People who practice mindfulness report higher levels of everyday happiness and fewer problems with regulating emotion. Number three, the breath. You know, if you don't think the breath is important, go 5 minutes without breathing and see what happens. Just kidding, don't do that. See, your breath is your life force. When you breathe deeply, you send oxygen to your brain, resulting in your thinking becoming more clear. You fill your body with more vitality and you improve blood flow and overall health. Okay, that's enough science. Now here's what you do. You can do this sitting in your car. You can do it in the morning after you finish brushing your teeth. Step number one, close and relax your eyes. Now smile. Authentic, genuine smile. Big smile. For about 15 seconds. It works even better if you picture somebody you love smiling at you and allow their smile to penetrate you. Step number two, now relax your smile and begin to take deep, spacious breaths. Inhale as deeply as you can and exhale out as much air as you can. Push it and relax those shoulders. Step number three, last step, focus all of your attention on now. Right now, not the past, not the future. Focus all of your attention on now, on your breath. If thoughts start to pop up, that's fine. Just bring your attention back to your breath, gently observing the thoughts. That's it. Ladies and gentlemen, set your timer on your phone and do this for 1 minute every day. You cannot do this wrong. You cannot fail at this. Just do it. According to William and Mary professor Peter Vishton, your brain will alter its happiness ratio and you will find yourself happier. Now you may say, oh, just 1 minute, that's it. But see, what we're doing is we're building a habit. And pretty soon you're gonna do this without thinking. And the more you do this, the more you breathe, the more you are mindful, and the more you smile, the greater your mental health will be. Peace. Hey guys, thank you so much for watching that video. Now, if you haven't joined the family yet, this is what I want you to do. I want you to click like on this page and click see first so that you never miss a beat. Now, for more insider information, offers, and just special challenges, go to my website at princeea.com and sign up for my personal email list. And the last thing I want you to do, you listening?
I'm Gary Nall. We're 23 minutes into our program. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, we're going directly into a clip. And this clip is modern feminism starting to undermine itself? The woman presenter at a Ted Austin conference this year is Jess Butcher. Mm-hmm.
any bristling in the audience with my somewhat controversial title, given that we sit here in a diversity-themed event. What I will say is just please bear with me, particularly because I'm going to be starting on such a positive note. There has never been a better time to be a woman. Never have women had as many opportunities as they do now to run countries, companies, to control their personal, financial, and sex lives. Girls outperform boys at school. More go to university. Women in their 20s and early 30s are frequently out-earning men. We should feel optimistic. And yet we're not. In fact, sometimes it seems all womanhood is depressed. Faced by an avalanche of information regarding the ongoing disparity in fortunes between women and men, by a narrative of disadvantage and societal patriarchy that runs through Me Too, the gender pay gap, the glass ceiling, and more. But how crystal cut are these assumptions? And what are the possible implications for how women respond to both opportunities and challenges in their lives? So who am I? A woman, yes, and a mother to three children under five. I'm a successful entrepreneur, enjoying a career where I get to deal with some of the biggest thinkers and doers in the world today, in business, in politics, in media, academia. I'm privileged, no question. My race, background, and opportunities mark me out as one of the privileged elite. What do I know about disadvantage? What's my agenda here? Well, as a woman, I'm a minority in my fields of technology and entrepreneurship. Hard industries to be a woman in, or so the narrative would have you believe. No, not so. I don't believe that this has been a disadvantage. Only the most incredible opportunity. One that has enabled me to stand out and get recognition. I describe myself as an entrepreneur, not a female entrepreneur, because I subscribe to a brand of feminism that told me I could be and do anything the boys could. And in fact, I've come to resent a move towards positive discrimination that might imply that any of my achievements would be down to anything other than merit. If I look back at all my good fortune, I can honestly say that to a large extent, it's been down to the love, support, and belief of the men in my life. My father, my husband, the bosses, business partners, peers, and mentors who've enabled my journey. But of course, the biggest advantage I possess is self-confidence and belief. And it's this that I want to look at in more detail today. Why is it seemingly so much harder to find in women than in men? And how might modern feminism be further undermining it? So talk of the gender pay gap is everywhere, and actually incorrectly assumed by 70% of the population to refer to women being paid less for the same work. Not true. Illegal, actually, and also nonsensical, as surely businesses would prefer to pay a cheaper workforce. The median disparity of 18.4% can, to a large extent, be explained by the choice of 42% of women to work part-time. The figure drops to 9.1% when you compare full-time to full-time, with this figure understandable to a degree by the fact that women are choosing different profession types. Women in their 20s and early 30s, as we've heard, are frequently out-earning men. The pay gap is negligible. It fluctuates. Some years, women out-earn men. And part-time women actually out-earn part-time men. So in effect, the headline statistic ignores many of the complicated variable factors beneath it, and in particular, a potential positive, that of female choice. The glass ceiling. It's been shattered time and time again by female heads of state and business leaders, demonstrating that for those women that do aspire to that sort of career, it's absolutely possible. But these are, of course, hard, masochistic almost lives, filled with imbalance, politics, stress, long hours. We can hardly even whisper any suspicion we may have that this is a lifestyle that fewer women and mothers aspire to, and arguably only the tiniest percentage of men. Right now, I'm currently observing a large number of some of my highest flying friends quietly leaning out of aspirations of making partner, away from 60-hour work weeks, with some choosing to quit altogether so as not to enjoy these early years of family life, myself included. 2 years ago, I made the decision to step back from the front seat of my business to spend more time with my three children. And it's a decision I will never regret. Having lost two friends recently, very early in their lives, it really brought home to me the fact that I will never get these years back. That's too important. But of course, women like me are partly responsible for the gender pay gap. And many of us may never go knocking on that glass ceiling because it's simply not a lifestyle that we desire. Those are just two of the big feminist issues of our time, with others, including Me Too, online trolling, body shaming and objectification, and domestic violence. All issues that you'd be forgiven for thinking were exclusively female. Now, there's been a lot of very good intention campaigning behind these issues, and some very positive byproducts, such as the light being shined on some of the more insidious ways in which some men can mistreat and underestimate women. And of course, on abuses of power. But my fear is that the broad spectrum, expanding definition of prejudice and harassment is now something that almost any woman can associate with. And we simply can't cry misogyny every time we're called out or held back in some way. I fear for an ideology and a rhetoric that's starting to set women against men, that focuses on what we can't do and haven't got, rather than what we can and have. My intention in seeking to shine light on some of the other side of these issues is not to deny the existence of discrimination that may exist in some of them, but to question their cumulative net effect, that of female victimhood. Feminism, like other forms of identity politics, has become obsessed with female victimhood. Whereas it once used to be about the portrayal of women as mature, equal partners in society, it now seems more to be about girl power. And yet it disempowers, assumes that we're weak and defenseless like children. Psychologists have long emphasized the power of beliefs to be borne out in reality, and how stereotypes contribute to social inequality. Confidence is, of course, self-fulfilling, something you will all have experienced. You look good, you feel good. You're told someone likes you, you're more relaxed around them. And conversely, if you suspect somebody doesn't like you, then you act in a more defensive, less confident way around them. Victims believe they are impotent and that they have no sense of control over the way that events unfold. Assuming that something has happened to you due to prejudice, whether right or wrong, is rarely the most productive response. It prevents introspection, self-analysis, and more importantly, particularly if it was due to prejudice, evaluation of new methods and techniques for circumventing your status quo. And what about men? Well, there's actually competition here for competitive victimhood if we want to play that game. Men have their own unique set of disadvantages that are rarely up for public discussion, including higher rates of school dropout, of mental health, vastly higher suicide rates, vastly higher workplace deaths, war deaths, deaths in crime, higher rates of homelessness, criminal court bias and sentencing disparity, where men receive nearly 60% longer sentences than women for the same crime, near equal domestic abuse rates, paternity fraud, child custody, and of course, reduced life expectancy. Even now, in this age of aspirational equality, the cry will go out, women and children first. Take, for example, the awful news story of Boko Haram and the terrorists that abducted the girls. Did you know that prior to this happening, those same terrorists had been abducting thousands of boys and murdering hundreds of boys and young men, burnt alive in their schools, shot in the streets? A situation that received no international attention until the terrorists turned their attention to the girls. And then, first ladies, media, celebrities, politicians up in arms. But why only then? Why are boys' lives seemingly valued so much less than girls? Whoever may have it worse, I take issue with a debating ground based on competitive victimhood. It's fruitless, it's destructive. Women are being encouraged to fear and distrust men, and men are more nervous and guarded in their interactions around women. And worse, resentful of a label of patriarchy, one the vast, vast majority don't recognize and who have their own challenges to face. Already, we're seeing some rather worrying byproducts to all of this, such as 5 times more men now less inclined to mentor women in the wake of Me Too. 75% of young girls yet to experience any form of discrimination talk about anxiety about it affecting their lives in some way. And working class girls have been deprived of jobs that they love, such as Page 3 girls and Grid girls, because other women disapprove of them. What happened to my body, my choice? It's okay for Kim Kardashian, but not for a Page 3 girl. And men have had their careers and reputations ruined overnight by Me Too. Some possibly justly, but without any due process, no innocence until proven guilty. And where might all this lead? Quotas leading to doubts in ability? Was my recent MBE because of positive discrimination? Am I on this stage because of it? Should we ban flirting on campus and in the workplace? Incidentally, two of the places where you're most likely to meet a life partner. Might companies start recruiting fewer women into entry-level, lower-paid work so as to even up their gender pay gaps? And if 50-50 is the ultimate aim, then shouldn't we be arguing for quotas for more men in the fields of nursing, teaching, veterinary science? More women on the front line, in construction, in refuse collection? And perhaps the three most important questions of all. Does power exist solely in the boardroom? At the highest levels of politics. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Okay. You were just listening to a person who believes in opportunity and that not all women, not all men are equal. And one of the things, her name is Jess, J-E-S-S, Butcher, B-U-T-C-H-E-R. That was a TED Talk Austin University, and I believe it was at the beginning of the year, or no, later in the year. One of the things that we have not understood is that not all men nor all women will ever even want to break a ceiling. When you walk down West End Avenue, and I did this just 2 nights ago, and as I was walking with my daughter and a friend, we looked up and I asked him, what do you think of these buildings? And he said, they're ugly. There's no sense of symmetry. And I was recalling we had a conversation about Lorenzo, one of the most important of the Medici's, that was Lorenzo, and how before he would build anything, he would ask, is there balance? Is there symmetry? Is there beauty? And if you didn't meet those three qualifications, it did not get built. And that's why when you go to one of the most beautiful cities in the world, not one of the largest, but one of the most unique in its architecture, that is the home of Michelangelo's David statue, plus thousands of other pieces of artwork that were commissioned over a 300-year period by the Medici's. And that was the height of the Renaissance from 1400 to 1700. You'll see one public place after another, parks after park. Now, these are not the private domains of the people who are in control. These were done for all people, and yet everything I saw was done for one's self, one's group, one's investment, without any sense of how it would fit. And then I asked my daughter, I said, Shelley, who builds this skyscraper? She says, well, no, different people with different skills. I said, yes, but they have different energies, like the person who's the engineer and the architect, that is a adaptive, assertive life energy. They love to create solutions to problems. The people who did the brick and mortar, the electrical plumbing, the masonry, the glazing, the framing, the foundational work, the excavation work, those are adaptive supportives. And then you have the people who designed the color schemes and the furniture and the interior, and that would be creative assertives. The people who oversaw the project and make sure that it goes forward would be the adaptive aggressives, the one group that can do multitasking. On their upside, they're great. On their downside, they're not. But the person causing this to be built was a dynamic aggressive. That is the only life energy that can cause anything major to work. And then I said, so when you look at these, you can tell whether a person was on the upside, downside, whether or not they did something that was concerning the whole community, or just the people going to be in their building? And there were over 42 of these new buildings just on 12th Avenue, which becomes West End Avenue. And I said, now look at the rest of the city. Look at the city under Moses. I'm talking about Robert Moses. And a different architecture, like Lincoln Center. I said, this is what we're dealing with. People thinking that everyone should take the same opportunity as everyone else. So if one person says, I'm happy being a farmer, other people say, should I be happy? Of course, we should all be happy. No, we shouldn't. And one of the things I notice in my own work when I'm counseling people is I try to get people aligned with their life energy that balances their conditioning and input, their intentional desires, their intentional ambitions, their intention to learn what they don't know as tools to help them. And when those two are harmonizing, you have someone who's going to succeed at what they're doing. But you want to see someone fail, take a brick person, a person that puts in the bricks and the windows and the frame, and ask them to go out and market this and to get the funding for it. Person be overwhelmed. You'd be handling more rejection than acceptance. You'd have to be dealing with special types of people who have the financing to do that. Each life energy has its own unique set of standards that must be met and to succeed. But even a dynamic energy who is succeeding can ultimately fail if what they're succeeding at is something negative. Hitler, dynamic. Donald Trump, a dynamic. Bill Clinton, a dynamic. Barack Obama, dynamic. Hillary Clinton, an adaptive aggressive on the double down side. She has no charisma at all. She couldn't even open her mail. She has no charisma. And then you have people who had charisma, but were on their upside. Franklin Roosevelt, you know, Dwight Eisenhower. Were they perfect? Far from it. But at least we, the people, benefited from many of their policies, though some of their policies were destructive. So we're dealing with people who all come packaged with conditioned responses, and if they're living with the right life energy, that woman, like this woman, looking at her and listening to her, that tells me she's dynamic. Because the only two people who are going to start their own businesses and succeed are dynamic assertives and dynamic aggressives. So and when I hear people saying, but everybody should have a chance to break the window, having the same chance is not the same as having the same proclivity. Huge difference. But whether we agree or disagree with someone, we should provide them a forum so we can hear what they have to say, and then agree or disagree. Censoring people because there's something about them that we don't like limits what we could benefit from. Now, I've invited Richard Gale to come on because Richard and I share something in common. We both believe that there are women historically and women today who would benefit society tremendously if those women were in a position of power. These are what I call the spiritual feminist. Now, I've befriended a lot of them, know them personally, we're friends. Barbara Seaman was one, as has Richard. And these are people worldwide, like Vandana Shiva. None of these women are inside, they weren't inside the second movement of feminism in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, and they're certainly not a part of the third wave today. And we're concerned about that. Because, yes, we all should support the rights of women and their opportunities and the balance that's necessary. No man should be paid more than a woman for doing the same work. But as you heard it explained, a lot of men go into professions that are going to earn more than a woman. So we're not talking about any of this today because we are not allowing those people to have forums on. So Richard, nice to have you with us. Give us your perspective and let us know some of the names of people that we should have information from and we're not hearing from.
Certainly. Good afternoon, Gary. I wanted to follow up with something you said because it was in 2012 that now we speak of the fourth wave of feminism.
I'm trying to think of the person's name that started that off. Well, Pythia Pihi, who actually was an old friend of mine. She was the first person to ever coin the term fourth wave back in 2005. But it's 2012 when it really came up. And what I think is new in the fourth wave, and which is now contributing to all this kind of negative identity politics and shaming and bashing that's going on, is that the fourth wave feminism is being defined by social media, and where it enables this kind of a militancy to publicly call out and shame people, whether or not they abuse their power or not. And so when we look at Me Too or the Yes All Women movement, there's another group, Feminista. These are all fourth wave movements now that work only through social media. And it's just, I was thinking about this and how this, it's not just related to feminism or radical feminism. It's related to everything we're seeing now and any kind of a bashing between alt-right, alt-left, Trump's Twitters and posts and other people. This is all part of the social media militancy and publicly shaming. And I think this has become now one of the vehicles that this fourth wave radical feminism that's creating all these kinds of issues that the woman we just listened to is speaking of, especially during the last 5 years. So I just wanted to make that point. It's kind of a new world of feminism that's creating the adding and further discrimination. But there are many of the we've mentioned, a lot of these people have been guests on the radio show. We used to have Charlene Spretnak, and hardly nobody even knows her name. She used to do a radio show, but people don't realize that she was one of the co-founders of the Green Party. And for the American Green Party, she's a retired professor of feminist theology. She's one of the first theoreticians for ecofeminism. And it was during the third wave, the early third wave, when ecofeminism kind of was given birth. And we don't, Donna Shiva would fall into that. Lynn Twist, who is a guest on the show, she's kind of a new age personality, but who's been working for indigenous women's rights and saving the rainforest for years and years. She's another one of these major ecofeminists. Reverend Sally Bingham, who I used to actually work with and consult for back in San Francisco. She's an Episcopalian minister at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, but she is a very dynamic woman who founded the Regeneration Project to move all faith communities towards adopting renewables, and she's been doing this since the 90s.
Richard, why don't we do this, because we're running out of time. Would you post a brief synopsis of the dozens of spiritual feminists, humanistic feminists, who we really need to hear from, because they are so wise, and these are the wise women, and they're excluded from all forms because they're not male haters, they're not into identity politics, and they have a lot of positive solutions that we need to hear from and create forms. So put it up on prn.fm and later today, and people can go there and hear about, the Lynn Twiss and the Karen Baker Fletcher and Ant Hoffman and Winona DeLuke and Sister Elizabeth McClaster and Sister Joan Chichester and many others, okay? And that's Richard Yale, our executive producer. One of our listeners asked me a question, and it dealt with who should we trust? Because after all, a lot of people are not aware of all the different occurrences around our country or around the world. It's a legitimate question. So I'm going to direct all of you to an article, and it's entitled, How Plutocratic Media Keeps Staff Aligned with Establishment Agendas. And it's by Catalin Johnstone. And here's what it has to say. I'll just read part of it. It says, why do mainstream media reporters within ostensibly free democracies act just like state media propagandists? Why are they so reliably pro-establishment? All throughout every mainstream outlet, why do they so consistently marginalize any idea that doesn't fit within the extremely narrow Overton window of acceptability? Why does anyone who inconveniences Western establishment power always find themselves on the losing end of a trial by media? Why are they so dependably adversarial towards anything that could be perceived as a flaw in any nation outside the U.S. centralized power alliance, and so dependably forgiving of the flaws of the nations within it? The way I see it is there are only two possible explanations for the unanimous consensus in mass media on these issues. One, the consensus exists because the mass media reporters are all telling the truth all the time. Or, two, the consensus exists because there's some kind of system in place which keeps the mass media reporters lying to us and painting a false picture about what's going on in the world. Those are the only two possibilities and can only have one be true, since any mixture of the two would result in a loss of consensus. Now, most mainstream Westerners harbor an unquestioned assumption that explanation one is the only possibility. The things they see on CNN and the BBC and ABC are all accurate descriptions of what really is going on in the world, and the consensus in their descriptions exists because they're all describing the same objective reality. Sound familiar? Well, here's what the person concludes, but what would that mean exactly? Well, for starters, if the mainstream media reporters are telling us the truth all the time, it would mean that the same power institutions which slaughtered millions in Vietnam and Iraq for no good reason are actually virtuous and honest. It would mean the positive and uncritical picture that is consistently painted of those same institutions which wage nonstop campaigns of bloodshed and oppression, to which are overall so positive that no criticism of them is needed. It would mean that the status quo of climate destruction, steadily growing wealth inequality, an increasingly Orwellian surveillance system, an increasingly militarized police, increasing internet censorship, and crushing neoliberal austerity measures are all things people voted for using the excellent democratic political system the mainstream media defends, based upon the accurate information the mainstream media gave them about what is in their best interest. So explanation one sounds improbable in that light. We know that the system is spectacularly screwed up, and we know that the political establishment, which these mainstream outlets always defend, does unforgivably evil things. So we should expect to see a lot more critical reporting and a lot less protecting of the status quo. But we don't. We see war crimes ignored, oppression justified, the two-headed one-party system normalized, dissent narratives smeared as fake news and conspiracy theories, and unproven assertions by government agencies with a known history for lying reported as unquestionable fact. But that leaves only explanation two. How could that be right? And then it goes on to discuss what people like Noam Chomsky and the BBC's Andrew Marr describe a foundational element of explanation two, that there's a system in place which ensures that all the reporters in positions of influence are there not to report factually on the news of the day, but to sell a particular narrative that is friendly to the state and the status quo. Chomsky describes a filtered system which ensures that only those loyal to the power rise to the top within the plutocratic-owned media, to which Marr objects and insists that his peers are brave truth-tellers who hold power to account. Subsequently, there was an exchange. It was an interesting exchange, and between the two, and I clearly believe that Chomsky won it. And let me just add my own point of view here, because I've seen it firsthand. I saw it when I did the first major national article on the politics of cancer. Until that time, there was no national article on the politics of cancer. There was one small one in New York Magazine, but Robert Houston and I did the first, called The Politics of Cancer. And it came from information from one of the cancer establishment's most respected, even revered figures, Pat McGrady Sr. His son, Pat McGrady Jr., award-winning journalist and bureau chief, news bureau chief for the Newsweek out of Moscow, gave me the story because they had read that I had done about 15 major exposés up to that point. And he said, I never will forget this in our first conversation, Gary, everything you've heard about cancer and the war on cancer and how we're winning, it's all lies. Everything that we are told, I create in my own office. I'm the one who does this. And he said, so I can tell you, I can get any person in the cancer establishment on the phone in 1, 2, 3 minutes. I can tell them whatever I want them to know, and they'll dutifully, without question, send that out through congressional hearings, through an article in one of the medical magazines, as if it were the gospel. He said, so you have a formidable task because the media considers anything relative to cancer as sacrosanct. You can't touch it. It's a sacred cow. And so I tried. Now, here's what people should understand. I first started with the liberal media, Ramparts and Evergreen and the East Village Other, Mother Jones, Atlantic, every good publication, Ms. Magazine, they all rejected it. Not because it wasn't newsworthy or accurate. We had an attorney who reviewed every single statement in there, and I had everything on tape. No, it's the media wouldn't touch the story, and because it would open a door to how deep this corruption went, how much rot was in the system. And McGrady sat on many occasions and would go over why the story was being stifled, why news editors will get a call from someone at the National Cancer Institute or someone from his office, historically, and they'd squash it. And that's how it works. So I saw that with my own eyes. And we won the Audi Award for Best Investigative Journalism for that article. It was published in a small East Side paper called Our Town. And he had the courage to do it. No one else did. But from there, another person introduced me to a publisher, a major publisher, who was his close personal friend, and he, against the advice of all of his staff, published it. As a result, that got out. Guess how many people in the national media wanted to do interviews with me on that story? Not one. Not a single person. So the problem is that we have a media that, by and large, tells the story only after it's been filtered to make sure that it does not in any way cause them to lose their power and position. And so we don't get the truth. And yet we weren't given the truth by the media on Vietnam. That came from a person inside, Daniel Ellsberg. We didn't get the truth about the Gulf of Tonkin from the media or from the government. We didn't get the truth about Vioxx killing over 60,000 people. In fact, none of the major scandals did we get the media from the mainstream, get the message from the mainstream media. So it's time that I believe that we simply question everything the media shares with us. Out of time, I want to thank you all for listening today, and we look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.